and welcome. It's Monday the 7th of June and you're listening to Career 24 on KBS World Radio. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. The government announced measures to reform the scandal-ridden Korea Land and Housing Corporation 3 months after a property speculation scandal rocked the nation, but shortly after a watchdog identified 12 lawmakers from the ruling Democratic Party to have engaged in such illegal alleged activities. We'll have more on these stories in our news briefing shortly. Later, we'll take a closer look at the landmark global corporation tax agreement that was reached by the G7 finance ministers on Saturday and what it could mean for South Korea as well. Plus, we'll carry out our post-game breakdown of South Korea's impressive 5-0 win over Turkmenistan. All that and more on today's Career 24.
존경하는 국민 여러분. LH 직원의 부동산 불법 투기 의혹이 제기된 지 3개월이 지났습니다. 그 사이에도
That was Land Minister Noh Hyung-wook announcing the government's latest anti-corruption drive, enforcing draconian measures to penalize employees of a state-run housing corporation who engage in speculative real estate deals. However, the announcement of these reform measures was somewhat overshadowed by news that ruling party lawmakers and their family allegedly took part in speculative real estate deals. Let's listen first to what Minister Noh had to say about the government's anti-corruption drive earlier at a press briefing.
LH 직원의 자산 등록 대상을 현재 임원 7명에서 전 직원을 대상으로
We will require all LH employees to report their assets, not just as top 7 executives. All of its employees will be prohibited from purchasing property for reasons other than to actually use or reside in. Workers that continue to own property for other reasons won't be eligible for promotion to senior positions. Even if their property is already included in a zone earmarked for state development projects, they won't receive compensation nor will they be eligible for reparative land, prohibiting them from gaining profit from speculative deals.
적발 시 강력한 제재를 가하겠습니다.
Joining us now to update us on the latest, as well as our other headlines of the day, is KBS World Radio news editor Woo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So the minister outlined measures to streamline the organization of a Korea Land and Housing Corporation, or LH, and put in place rigorous compliance regulations. Now, these measures are aimed at addressing public outrage over what it regards as a systematic corruption within the government regarding property speculation, and it is said to be one of the factors that led to the ruling party's humbling defeat in the April by-election.
Indeed. The government put forth a reform package which includes a gradual cutback of 20% of the workforce at the scandal-ridden state firm, LH, or around 2,000 employees. The ministry will take over selecting new sites for public housing development to prevent information leaks at its and non-housing welfare and supply functions will be dispersed to other public agencies and municipal governments. The minister also pledged a harsher consequence for those who abuse access to classified information. Let's listen to more on what he had to say.
내부 정보를 활용하여 사익을 편취하는 경우에는
If LH employees use insider information for personal gain, they will be dismissed or expelled and face legal action. We will reinforce inspection and monitoring systems.
LH 임직원의 토지 투기 등을
Now, stern consequences indeed coming 3 months after the property speculation scandal first came to light. Mm-hmm. But the announcement of the drive was marred by an announcement later in the day that a dozen ruling party lawmakers were allegedly involved in speculative real estate deals.
Unfortunately so. According to a probe conducted by the state-run Anti-Corruption and Civil Rights Commission, these lawmakers and their family members with the Democratic Party were allegedly involved in the 16 cases of shady property deals, with six involving violations of the Farmland Act, followed by three breaches of work-related confidentiality and one infringement of architectural regulations. The agency launched its comprehensive probe at the request of the ruling party. party itself on the heels of the LH scandal earlier this year. The DP plans to take appropriate measures in line with the agency's findings, and it also made calls on the opposition faction to undertake similar probes on their own lawmakers.
Yes, this could have significant consequences for the ruling party, especially with the presidential elections coming up next year as well. So we'll have to keep a watch of the fallout as it develops. Let's turn now to bilateral tensions between South Korea and Japan. A South Korean district court has dismissed the largest ever wartime labour compensation lawsuit targeting 16 Japanese companies, including Nippon Steel Corporation and Mitsubishi Materials Corp., in contrast to an earlier case. Can you tell us more?
Yes, indeed. The Seoul Central District Court said on Monday the case was not even sufficient to proceed with a hearing and gave what is tantamount to a dismissal and a loss for the 85 plaintiffs in the case. These plaintiffs and their legal representatives told reporters outside the courthouse that they would immediately file an appeal. The case was the largest wartime compensation suit against Japanese companies to date and seemingly contradicts the previous ruling by the Korean Supreme Court in October 2018, which ordered Nippon Steel to pay 100 million won, or what is equivalent to $88,000 each, to Korean victims of Japanese forced labor during World War II. The court made a similar ruling in November 2018 against Mitsubishi Heavy Industries.
Moving on to other headlines now, the number of South Korea's new COVID-19 cases fell to the 400s for the first time in 6 days. And a Moderna executive has reportedly hinted that the US company may produce a stock solution for its vaccine in South Korea. Can you tell us the latest?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 485 additional new infections, raising the country's cumulative caseload to 144,637, with the decline largely due to less tests taken over the weekend. Corinne Le Goff, the chief commercial officer of Moderna, said during an interview with Yonhap News that her firm is considering producing the solution in South Korea, which means it would cooperate with South Korea not only in vaccine manufacturing, but also in research. South Korean biotech firm Samsung Biologics recently signed a consignment deal to manufacture Moderna vaccines at its local factory. And the government reiterated that it will likely hit its target of inoculating at least 13 million people by the first half of this year.
On the North Korea front, South Korea's unification minister, Lee Myung, called for maximum flexibility in regards to combined military exercises with the US slated for August. Now, during an in-depth discussion on KBS on Sunday, the minister said that the drills should in no way cause or further escalate tension on the Korean Peninsula. What else did he say exactly?
Well, as our listeners are well aware, Pyongyang has consistently demanded that all South Korea-US joint maneuvers be suspended in order for any dialogue to resume. As such, Minister Lee said Seoul and Washington should arrange their upcoming combined exercises in a less intimidating way to the North. Now, let's listen to his remarks.
One thing I would like to clearly state is that I don't want to see these combined exercises exacerbate tensions on the Korean Peninsula or be used to aggravate the situation. So I believe that the government should exercise maximum flexibility in adjusting policies, and then North Korea should also, in return, approach the issue with great flexibility.
Now, we also have to keep in mind that these joint exercises are essential in the planned transfer of wartime command of the Allied forces from the US to South Korea.
Indeed. And with less than a year remaining in the Moon Jae-in administration, the minister also said he wants to revive suspended inter-Korean tourism to the scenic Mount Kumgang in the north for elderly families separated by the Korean War as soon as the government is able to get a handle on the COVID-19 pandemic. And as for why the head of South Korea's spy agency, Park Ji-won, visited New York City city last month where North Korean diplomats are stationed at the UN headquarters, Lee said he is not aware of any inter-Korean contact there, noting that he is willing to put all efforts into official and open settings. Lee said that he is open to visiting Pyongyang as a special envoy and restore the suspended dialogue channels between the two Koreas.
Next, President Moon called for measures to enhance military culture following the apparent suicide of a non-commissioned officer in the Air Force who was allegedly sexually assaulted by a colleague. Can you give us the latest?
Yes, according to presidential spokesperson Park Yong-mi, Moon said during an internal meeting on Monday that the latest incident has caused public outcry and cannot go unchecked and must serve to fundamentally overhaul the overall culture at the military. To that end, the president ordered the launch of a task force that also involves non-military participation. He said a system must be established to prevent similar events from happening again, and urged Parliament to swiftly pass a revision to the Military Court Act pending in the National Assembly's Legislation and Judiciary Committee. Moon's head of Air Force resigned on Friday. Prosecutors raided the Air Force and the 20th Fighter Wing as part of its probe on whether it dragged its feet before reporting it up the chain of command. The alleged perpetrator was arrested on Wednesday on charges of forcibly committing an indecent act and inflicting bodily harm. The family of the deceased has brought charges against a public defender who initially handled the case on charges of negligence.
Yes, that's all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Coming up next, in-depth news analysis. You're listening to Korea 24 from KBS World Radio.
Finance ministers from the Group of Seven Nations agreed a deal on Saturday, which Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, described as truly historic. The nations agreed that multinational companies would have to pay a minimum tax rate of at least 15% in each country they operate. Now, these companies had faced criticism for many years for avoiding paying taxes by setting up headquarters in countries that had lower tax rates. Hardest affected will likely be tech and online businesses such as Google, Facebook and Amazon. To discuss the implications of this deal further and what it could mean for South Korea as well, we have joining us on the line now Professor Shin Se-dun, who is a professor of economics at Sungmyung Women's University. Professor, thank you for speaking to us today.
Good evening. Yeah.
So, Professor, what did you make of this deal from the weekend reached upon by the G7 member nations? How significant is this?
Well, as someone said, it is quite historical. And in some sense, it's going to become pretty monumental in the sense that it will probably change the course of international corporate tax system from now to a globally unified the corporate tax system in near future. So far in many countries have been suffered from the problems of base erosion and the profit shifting, which means that, most of the, big tech companies like Google, Netflix changed their home office to a country with very low or non-existing corporate tax country like, many tax havens. So many companies making huge profits try to evade tax, and that has been kind of headaches for many countries and for many years. And it is, after more than 10 years of discussion, it is, I think, fortunate that, major country G7 were able to strike an agreement. And that, I think, is pretty historical.
Can you tell us some more details about the agreement? Can you explain for us what does a global minimum corporate tax mean exactly and how would it be imposed?
Yeah, first, some countries, even, including Canada, their corporate tax rate is pretty low. And there are many countries, you know, where there's no corporate tax at all. So corporates, you know, which are making huge profits, have a tendency to move their operation from their own countries to these low-tax countries. We call it tax haven. So eventually they are evading their tax, and that has been eroding, you know, tax kind of a base for many countries, and which has been a headache for many countries, including the United States. So now with the minimum corporate tax agreement by 15%, every country has to at least, you know, collect the 15% corporate tax. That is a first, I think, a significance. And second, you know, important thing is that, you know, many countries try to kind of entice, you know, foreign firms. They have a tendency to lower their corporate tax. And with this kind of agreement, it's going to become very difficult for any country to lower the tax, especially corporate tax. So I think that's the second most important kind of contribution by this agreement.
How do you think it could change the landscape of how these companies operate?
Well, you know, for example, Korea, the corporate tax is already, you know, higher than 15%, so would not be affected very much. But there are some countries like Singapore, Canada, or, you know, Ireland. Those countries have levied a very low corporate taxes. So for that country, I think possibility that some international, multinational corporations will move from their country to probably other countries. So I think there is going to be a tremendous kind of movements of, you know, companies from one country to other country. That, I think, is one thing that we could expect. And another thing is that, you know, if, you know, 15% minimum corporate tax is established, next step will be that, you know, they will raise that minimum rate from 15% to maybe 17% or 20%. Because many countries already, you know, levying more than 25% corporate tax. So I think naturally, next step, I think, will be countries will be trying to get an agreement to raise the minimum corporate tax from 15% to some higher level in the future.
The U.S. had initially proposed a 21%, but after negotiations, they put it down to 15%. The countries agreed to that. Some criticism already that 15% is too low and they should have stuck with the 21%. What do you make of that criticism?
Yeah, I think that is pretty kind of a, you know, reasonable approach because, you know, like the United States and many European countries after COVID-19, they have a huge kind of, you know, resources need to kind of amend the damage done by COVID-19. So every country feel, you know, kind of need to collect more taxes and corporates, you know, income taxes, especially those corporate, you know, making huge profits under the digital kind of a revolution. I think it's a proper target for their, you know, tax revenues. So I think it's pretty natural for them to raise, you know, the tax rate from 15% to some higher level. And another thing is that those, you know, big tech companies like Google, Netflix, you know, Amazon, you know, those Facebook, they have been evading the corporate taxes for long. So in order to kind of recollect, you know, those foregone tax revenue, I think it's pretty natural for them to raise, you know, from 15% to some higher level.
So the G7 countries agreed to this agreement. But how do you think other countries will react to this? As we mentioned, there are countries like Ireland and Canada which had courted companies with their lower tax rates. What would they think about this deal?
Well, they oppose, naturally. They will oppose because they have been surviving, you know, the economy depending upon, you know, pretty kind of a beneficial corporate taxes by which, you know, they were able to induce or kind of, you know, introduce, you know, many foreign corporations, multinationals into their country. So I think there will be some kind of opposition. But if, you know, every country levy the same rate, there will be no more advantage for one country over the other. So I think if the tendency is to raise the minimum corporate tax rate to 15%, and there is no exception to that. I think Canada or Ireland has no other choice to accept that. So I think if that happens, I think, you know, that's going to be the game changer, in the sense that, you know, every country in the world has to levy the same corporate tax, and there's no exception to that. By that system, I think, you know, there will be no competitive lowering of corporate tax try to induce, you know, foreign multinationals into their economy, which has been the case for the last, I think, two or three decades.
Now, I want to ask you how this might affect South Korea. Let's first talk about the large companies doing business here in Korea, such as, say, Google or Netflix. You mentioned earlier that this tax might not mean much for them because they're already paying a higher tax rate here.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you compare Naver to Google, the amount of transaction is almost the same in Korea, but the amount tax, you know, Google is paying is about one-tenth of the Naver. So it is really the problem that some of the, you know, foreign internationals are paying tremendously low income taxes, corporate income taxes in Korea. So I think government is expecting a little bit of increase in the corporate tax revenues from those, you know, international big players. But also, you know, some Korean companies like Samsung, SK, POSCO, LG, they have operated, you know, some, you know, foreign, you know, multinationals in tax havens. So for them, I think they have to pay more taxes to either their country or to Korea. So I think, you know, the government is trying to figure out how the benefits and costs of the system, but the government is pretty tentative, you know, what will be the overall impact upon Korean tax revenues. So I think the Korean authority is pretty kind of a tentative or kind of reserving, you know, kind of attitude too. But in general, I think the Korean government or Korean tax authority will be pretty sympathetic to this change.
Can you explain a bit more for us? You said earlier that Google is perhaps paying only a tenth of what a Naver is paying here. Can you explain that situation for us?
Yeah, the last year, some of the, you know, professors has estimated that Google's, you know, sales in Korea has been $3 billion and paid only $20 million for that sales. But in the case of Naver, the sales has been almost $4 billion and paying about, you know, $400 million. So if you compare the size of, you know, $3 billion sales for Google and the $4 billion sales of Naver, but the amount the Naver is paying, you know, in Korean authority is about $400 million American dollar, but Google only pays $20 million, which is about 1/20. I think there has been a lot of complaints, you know, made by some, you know, so societies, Korean societies, asking that, you know, Google has to pay at least, you know, the legitimate kind of a share of their corporate income. But Google says, you know, many of the corporate, you know, many of the sales has been conducted, you know, outside, so it is not the subject of Korean tax system, and the amount that they pay is only the kind of the revenue they accrued from sale of kind of, you know, kind of advertisements. So I think there has to be straightened out, you know, how the Google have to pay in Korean tax system.
So would this agreement by the G7 leaders mean that Google would have to pay more?
Well, yeah, that's another story, because the agreement made by G7 is kind of a fundamental or symbolic agreement. There are a lot of, you know, details that have to be straightened out in the future, right? So without any detail, I think it is premature to say that, you know, Google has to pay more in Korea than before. And so there's a problem of straightening it out of the details. That is the first kind of challenge. And second challenge is, even if there has been made kind of a detail straightened out, you know, next step is international institutions like international organizations such as IMF or OECD has to kind of level up to the level of international treaty. That's the second step. Even if, you know, international treaty was ratified, it has to follow, you know, domestic process. You know, every country has the authority, as long as the, you know, the tariff, the tax matter is concerned. So there are a lot of process, you know, we have to make it an international treaty. And before that, we have to have straighten out many details. And after that, you know, we have to have international treaty. And then that has to be ratified by a local parliament or Congress. It's a long process, and it's premature, you know, to say that, you know, this kind of agreement is going to be adopted or accepted, you know, next year or next month. So it is, as I said, it is the first step. First, the symbolic step of, you know, changing the game.
I see. You mentioned earlier about South Korean companies doing business overseas. How would they be affected by this potential change in the tax scheme?
Well, you know, if this law becomes effective, you know, Samsung, you know, LG, SK, which operates international or, you know, or kind of multinational corporations, mostly in tax havens, they have to pay more taxes to the country on which, you know, they operate. So so there will be no more tax haven benefits of, you know, multinationals. Not just Korea, but all the global multinationals, you know, located in the tax havens. So some countries have to pay a little more corporate income taxes. And in that case, I think they might change their, you know, operation, base of operation from, you know, the multinational, I mean, the tax haven to some other country. So I think the government is expecting it, you know, that there will be some kind of positive effect of reshoring, meaning that, you know, some Korean companies which had gone out to the overseas kind of, you know, locations, they probably might come back. But I think we have to see, because, you know, now Korean, you know, corporate tax is about 25%, relatively higher to some other countries, you know, higher than 15%, but lower than 25%. So those kind of companies may come back, but I think there are many other kind of a potential opportunity for them to move in. So I think it is premature for the Korean government to expect kind of a reshoring of Korean firms due to this G7 agreement.
I see. And as we said, there's a long road ahead, but what steps do remain for this global minimum tax to work and actually come into effect? And finally, do you think it will happen?
Well, first, you know, there has to be a lot of details, a lot of details. You know, who's going to pay? Where do they pay? How do they pay? There are so many details to be straightened out. So first, I think, you know, the levels of, you know, high levels of G7 countries will try to get reach a kind of agreements on the detail. And second step is that each country, internationally kind of a binding treaty has to be ratified. And then each country Congress has to follow up, you know, to make that international treaty as effective as any, you know, domestic law. So I think it's going to take a long process, at least, you know, several years. So I think we have to see, you know, how those difficult processes and difficult kind of processes will be straightened out in the future.
So a potentially very long process, but the first symbolic step in a potentially historic change.
Right.
That is where we'll leave it, Professor. We've been speaking to Professor Shin Se-dong from Sungmyung Women's University. Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update.
The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index gained 12.04 points, or 0.37%, on Monday, ending the day at 3,252.12. Meanwhile, the tech-heavy KOSDAQ dropped, losing 1.72 points, or 0.17%, to close at 985.86. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 3.6 won against the dollar, ending the session at 1,112.9 won.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We carry on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending, rounding up some of the other popular news stories that have been looked up online in Korea Today. Contributor Bruce Harrison joins us on the line now. For that, Bruce, hello.
Good afternoon, Jung-ho.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, first off, Jung-ho, we're going to learn about a crackdown on shops that offer rental services of sex dolls. We're also going to discuss a false bomb threat called in at a Busan subway station, as well as the police response to that threat. And then lastly, we're going to find out why Israel is doing away with its indoor mask-wearing mandate next week.
Okay, we begin with an issue that's been garnering more and more attention as of late. Bruce, can you tell us more?
Sure. Police departments have teamed up with the Ministry of Gender Equality and Family, as well as local governments, to crack down on sex doll experience shops beginning on Monday. The enforcement period is set to last for 2 months. Now, this move comes in response to growing public opposition to establishments that display sex dolls and provide rental services. So just last Monday, a petition was posted on the presidential office's website calling for the suspension of all those shops that are located in busy urban districts. The petition was filed by a citizen who expressed concern about a 24-hour sex doll experience shop that is set to open in a business district in Wijongbu. This petitioner added that children and teenagers pass through this neighborhood every day. As of 7:30 a.m. Monday, the petition had gathered around 18,000 signatures.
Right. We should point out that it's not illegal to import or sell sex dolls or even operate such shops. So then how do the police plan to crack down on these shops, as you said earlier?
Well, yes, it's not illegal to import or sell them, but it is illegal to run these shops, operate them within 200 meters of schools. As far as regulations go, the police plan to invoke the Juvenile Protection Act in order to charge sex doll experience shops that put up ads or signs containing contact information. Given that such shops are categorized as recreation facilities, police will also penalize any shops that lack the necessary structures for such facilities, according to the nation's construction law. Police plan to take action based on complaints that these shops sexually objectify women and negatively impact the way teenagers perceive sex. One parent commented that it would be very awkward if their children were to ask what sex dolls are. The parents expressed concerns that the presence of sex doll experience shops in busy neighborhoods can lead young people to develop unhealthy beliefs about sex at a time when they are greatly affected by their surroundings.
Yes, I understand that some people, though, have criticized the regulations as being too excessive. Can you tell us more about why that is?
Sure, Jung-ho. Some people believe the police are aggressively implementing the crackdown as a way to mitigate public outcry regarding sex doll experience shops, even though it's legal to run them. Sex doll experience shops have grown in number after the Supreme Court upheld a ruling back in 2019, June of that year, a ruling in favor of importing life-size sex dolls.
Right. The concern is that these shops are too open to the public. Some places have put up big signs on their buildings, which anyone, including children, can read as they pass by. And as you mentioned earlier, that it is illegal to run these shops within 200 meters of schools, but not for after-school private academies or hagwons. And the reports that such a shop is operating in the same building as hagwons that teach young children as well. So there is concern there. But as we mentioned, legally, these places are allowed to operate. So authorities have their hands tied somewhat. So it looks like this will continue to be an issue for a while. Let's turn to our second story now. What do you have for us?
Jung-ho, around 20 police officers combed through Sasong Station on Busan Metro's line number 2 around 8:40 Monday morning after they received a report someone had planted a bomb there. Fortunately, police did not discover any explosives within the station, although they did apprehend a man in his 40s who is believed to be responsible for the false bomb threat.
Right. The whole incident must have caused quite a disruption in subway operations, given that it occurred during rush hour. How long did the police search the station for?
Well, the search lasted for about 10 minutes. During that time, the Busan Transportation Corporation ordered an evacuation of Sasong Station. Now, while police conducted their search, 6 subway trains passed through the station without stopping, thus causing significant disruptions in subway service. Passengers unable to get off the train at Sasong wondered why the train hadn't made his usual stop, and they were startled to find out later that there had been a bomb threat there.
And you said, Bruce, that the police tracked down the caller of this false report.
That's right. They detained the man. He was found inside the station, and now they're questioning him. He apparently is said to suffer from severe disabilities.
I see. Now, how often do incidents like this occur in Busan, and what are the penalties for those who make false reports like this?
Well, last year, Jungle, Busan police received a total of 214 false reports. This year, there have been roughly 100 up to this point. These incidents are not only a strain on police resources, but they also hinder police from responding to more pressing emergencies, real emergencies. Consequently, police seek to punish those who make these false reports by fining them or hitting them with charges, rather, of obstructing police duties. And it depends on the case exactly what the punishment is. On Sunday, for example, police in Busan received a call around 9:30 p.m. from a man who reported that his friend had been swept away in the river. Police immediately sent two patrol cars and three fire trucks and searched areas near the river, but they did not locate the caller or the victim, he reported. Later came to light, Jung-ho, the man had given a false report while under the influence. He was arrested on Monday on charges of making a false report.
Right. As you said, these nuisance calls are, of course, a drain on resources and manpower. But Monday's incident in Busan particularly seemed to have caused quite a lot of disruption. As we said, it seemed came during the morning rush hour, a reminder of the impacts of such false reports. Let's turn to our final story now, and we're looking overseas for this one.
That's right, Jung-ho. We're looking towards Israel. There, the government will end mandatory indoor mask wearing as soon as next week. This is after a sharp drop in COVID-19 infections and high vaccination rates. At an event paying tribute to the nation's health workers on Sunday, Israeli Health Minister Yuli Edelstein announced the government's plan to lift its indoor mask mandate on Tuesday of next week.
Yes, Israel was one of the first countries in the world to launch a vaccination program, of course. How much of the population has been vaccinated so far?
Yeah, they got out to an early start, and since that rollout began last December, an estimated 55% of its population has been vaccinated. That's roughly 5.1 million people. In his remarks on Sunday, the health minister noted that 5 months ago, the number of daily COVID-19 cases in Israel hovered around 10,000, but on Saturday, just a couple of days ago, that figure stood at only 4. He also reported the number of critically ill patients reached just 37 on Sunday.
Okay, so no more mandatory indoor mask wearing soon, but I understand that that rule doesn't apply for schools.
That's right. So in a bid to smoothly achieve herd immunity among the country's youth, the government has opted to continue enforcing the mask mandate in schools for the time being. This comes as Israel began inoculating teenagers between the ages of 12 and 15 on Sunday, with 10,000 teenagers out of approximately 600,000 people in that age bracket having already reserved vaccines.
Right. Interest is high in Israel's situation, of course, because they are so far ahead with their vaccination programs. And it's like getting a glimpse into the future for the rest of the world concerning the pandemic as well. Looking forward to mask-free days as well. Where we'll leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Bruce, and we'll talk again next time.
Thanks, Jung-ho. Goodbye.
It's time now for Monday Sports Roundup, our weekly segment covering the world of Korean sport. Joining me now on the line with the latest updates is sports journalist Yoo Ji-ho from the Yonhap News Agency. Ji-ho, hello.
Hi.
It's great to speak to you again. We begin with football because the South Korean national men's team turned on the style and trounced Turkmenistan 5-0 in their World Cup qualifying match on Saturday. It was an invigorating win for the team and the manager, who'd faced a criticism after their limp loss to Japan earlier this year. Ji-ho, it was a comfortable win to say the least, but they also did manage to impress.
Yeah, you know, this is the type of victory that Korea needed. As you mentioned, coming off the loss to Japan a few months back, fans were still infuriated, really angered with that effort in the loss. And they needed to not only win, but also look good doing that. And, you know, that hadn't been always the case in recent past. But in this one, with Hwang Mi-jo grabbing a brace and three players each chipping in a goal, this is an easy victory at Goryang Stadium. And their captain, Son Heung-min, also really thrived as the facilitator on the offense without scoring any goal himself. Again, this is the type of quality performance that Korea needed. And, you know, they really defeated the team that they were supposed to beat. I don't think that anybody really doubted that Korea was going to win the match. It was just a matter of how they were going to do it. And Turkmenistan, predictably, set up a low block. I really had, 9 to 10 players in the zone trying to, I guess, do the best they could to fend off Korean attack. And I think Korean players really play with a lot of patience and composure. And they broke down the wall with some crisp passing, letting their superior skills really shine and take over over the course of the match. In the first half, Korea managed 2 goals. I think they should have really had a lot more. The Turkmenistan goalkeeper made some really great saves to keep the score more respectable. But I think, they just ran out of steam in the second half and Korea just piled on. And Coach Paul Bentu said after the match that he was very satisfied, one, with the result and also with the performance. And he was happy for the players that they won the match so handily, so convincingly. And, he pointed out, and I think he's right, that scoring 5 goals is not easy against any team. And, again, the Korea could have scored a lot more except for the goaltending, goalkeeping from the other team. And this is a very, I guess, satisfying victory on a lot of fronts.
Right. Admittedly, Turkmenistan were really poor. If you look at the stats, South Korea had 75% possession, 27 shots to Turkmenistan's 3, including 16 on target for Korea and none for Turkmenistan. But South Korea can only beat what's in front of them, of course, and Korea did really well breaking through that defence. Do you think this eases some of the criticism that Bento had been getting, not just the margin of win, but as we've mentioned, the performance as well?
Yeah, I think it's a good first step toward that. It's hard to this fan base is hard to please. So it's going to take more than one match to really change the narrative. And next up, we've got Sri Lanka on Wednesday and Lebanon on Sunday. So again, a couple of more winnable matches, even though Korea was held to a scoreless draw by Lebanon when they played in Lebanon about a year and a half ago in November 2019. So, win those two and do it once again convincingly. I think then fans will kind of, maybe ease up on Bento and the national team. But one match, it's probably not enough, but this is a good first step toward that.
As you said, next up is Sri Lanka on Wednesday, 8 p.m. Korea time, which should be another win. So hopefully we will continue to see a similar level of performance then as well. Meanwhile, sticking with football, let's turn now to the men's Olympic team, who will play 2 friendly matches against Ghana, the first of which is coming up on the weekend as well. Can you set that up for us, Gio?
Sure. Our first match will be Saturday down in Jeju Island, 7 p.m. kickoff Korean time. It will be the first of 2 pre-Tokyo Olympics tune-up for Korean team. Ghana did not qualify. They just finished shy of qualifying out of Africa there. Coach Kim Ak-bum, one of maybe final chances, if not the final chance, to see some players in match action before finalizing his 18-man Olympic roster. And, there was a bit of a concern last week when one Ghana player tested positive for COVID-19 after landing in Japan for a match there in Japan. The rest of the team was all fine. They went ahead with their match scheduled, as was on Saturday. But, Japan won that match 6-0, and that led to some concerns that Ghana may not present enough of a test for Korea because, you don't want to be playing someone that's overmatched. You want to be playing somebody kind of even on your skill level, kind of give yourself a good test ahead of the Olympics. And, some of the Korean players on the Olympic team had an interview earlier Monday, and they watched the match, and they said, as poorly as Ghana may have played, Japan was just that good. And, it was more of Japan being really good than Ghana being really bad. I think the Korean players, they're going to have to be careful with Japan if they do end up playing them during the Olympics, but maybe not worry so much about Ghana not being good enough to give them much of a test.
Right. And as you've mentioned before, these warm-up matches are important because Coach Kim hasn't finalized his Olympic squad, right? So players will need to impress you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's only 18-man roster. And right now in the training camp, I think they have 24, 25 players. So some of them would have to go home. And if you look at the three overage player spots, Olympic tournament this year being under 24, but teams can select up to three players each over the age limit. So you're really looking at 15 spots for under 24 players. So there's a lot of competition. And you're looking at someone like Lee Kang-in or Chung Woo-young from Bundesliga, they might be shoo-ins just because of their superior skill sets and their experience in Europe. They might be all about guaranteed spots. So that's down to, something like 11, right?
Mm.
So it's not a lot. And the players, I think, understand that. It's going to be a tough choice, I think, for Kim and also a tough choice for the players to accept when it comes to that.
Right, so the players will be looking to impress on Saturday, 7 p.m. Korea time, facing Ghana in a friendly. Let's turn to baseball now. In the Major League Baseball, two Korean players have unfortunately been placed on the injured list for the second time this season. Choi Ji-man of the Tampa Bay Rays is dealing with a groin issue, and Kim Kwang-hyun of the St. Louis Cardinals has back problems once again as well. Can you update us on the latest deal?
Sure. Well, Choi Ji-man suffered left groin strain earlier in the week, last week, and was put on the 10-day injured list on Friday. And that was retroactive to the previous day. Choi missed the early portion of the season after right knee surgery during spring training. He said the knee's still not 100%, and maybe he developed some bad habits, putting extra burden on the left side of his lower body, which might have led to some groin issues. But he said the injury is nothing serious. The team just decided to give him some time to recover, and he should be back once his 10 days are up. Probably not the same story for Kim Kwang-hyun, who exited his start on Friday or Saturday morning in Korean time before the start of the fourth inning because of lower back tightness. He threw a warm-up pitch against the Cincinnati Reds. He kind of called to the bullpen, to the dugout, brought out the trainer, and took himself out of the game. The inning before that, he was at the plate. He ran hard to first base and stepped on it kind of hard. He might have hurt himself there when he was trying to run out of ground ball. It's admirable for him to be playing so hard, but pitchers, they should really take it easy, I think, at some point, because pitching is their primary job,
right?
Not trying to leg out an infield single. So it's the same issue that sidelined him at the start of this year, lower back tightness. And on the mound, when he was on the mound, he wasn't particularly good either. Gave up two homers in three innings and suffered his fourth straight loss for the season.
Right, we'll see how they do, but hopefully they will recover quickly. Let's finish up with some LPGA action now. Two Korean players tied for seventh place at the U.S. Women's Open in San Francisco, a tournament for which Korea had produced the past two champions. But that streak stopped this year. Can you tell us more, Gio?
Sure. Well, it was Ko Jin-young and Park In-bi, world number one and world number two, finishing at one over par, 285, tying for seventh at Olympic Club in San Francisco. Ko shot a 2-under-69. She had three birdies and a bogey. Park In-bi, who is a two-time U.S. Women's Open champion, had a 72 one-over on Sunday, three birdies against four bogeys. Yuka Saso of the Philippines defeating Nasa Hataoka in a playoff to win it, tying Park In-bi's record for the youngest Women's Open champion at 19 years old, actually coming down to the day, month and a day. They're exactly the same age. when they won the U.S. Open there. Lee Jung-un, the 2019 champion, was in contention coming into the final round, shot a 76 in the final round to tie for 12th. Last year's champion, Kim Ah-rim, actually missed the cut, shot a 79 and 70 in her title defense. But the next major comes in only 2 weeks' time. We've got the KPMG Women's PGA Championship out in the state of Georgia coming up, and Korean player Kim Tae-young, world number three, is the defending champion.
Right, so there's that to look forward to then. We'll leave it there for our Monday Sports Roundup. Thank you for those updates, Jihua, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And that is all we have for our show today. Before we go, I have enough time to remind our listeners that you can always listen to our show on our website, as well as our apps at KBS Kong, KBS World Radio and KBS World Radio On Air. You can also catch our show on shortwave in various regions. For details of frequencies, check out our website, world.kbs.co.kr. You can also catch up with previous episodes of the show as a podcast on our website as well as various other popular podcast platforms, including Naver Audio Clip. Just search for Career 24. Please like, subscribe and leave a comment as well. Tomorrow we have another special guest interview for Touch Base in Seoul, as well as our daily news updates and analysis, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Chang-woo, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.